All right, I'm Tarek. I'm addict, alcoholic.
Tarek.
Page 44. So in the next hour, we are going to wrap up the first step and cover steps 2 and 3. And then after Danny speaks, we will cover step 4 and hopefully step 5. Maybe even 6 and 7. We'll see. The big book's amazing in how it lays concepts out. The book tells you what it's about to tell you, then it tells it to you, and then it tells you what it just told you. It's very repetitive in that way. And so on the top of page 44, it sums up everything we've done. In the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something of addiction and alcoholism. We hope we've made a clear distinction between the addict, alcoholic, and the non-addict, non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, which is the obsession, or if when drinking or using you have little control over the amount you take, which is the physical craving, you're probably an addict or alcoholic. So if you look into your experience, do you find these? Do you have both? If so, you've lost power. You've lost control. And you've lost choice. And you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And here's the question you have to talk about when you're taking someone through the work. Do you believe this process is your only solution? Or are there other solutions that are possible for you? To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic or addict of the hopeless variety, which is somebody that wants to quit with all that they are, but they cannot. To be doomed an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. This is very similar to what we talked about earlier when we were talking about step zero, the wonderfully horrific time burning all the alternatives to the ground until you're left with these two alternatives. You know, for me, it was years and years of if I get the right job, it'll solve the drug problem and the alcohol problem. If I get the right girl, it'll solve the drug problem and the alcohol problem. If I can just make my parents proud, it will solve the alcohol and the drug problem. It was almost everything was going to solve the alcohol and the drug problem, but it was always searching outside of myself to find the solution. If I could just get everything right in my external world, it would solve all my problems, but that's not the reality of my situation. That's not what was going on. So I used page 44 and one paragraph on page 45 because I want to stress this. It says, the lack of power, that's my dilemma. I have to find a power by which I can live. It doesn't say I need to find a power by which I can stop smoking crack or stop drinking alcohol. It says I need a power to live. So therefore, the problem must incorporate an aspect of not being able to live. That's why I must seek power. Because if I seek power, I will create a life that's conducive to sobriety. That's what's going on here. That's why we go through these actions. Obviously, we have to find a power greater than ourselves. But where and how are we to find this power? The process is laid out in this book. So what I want to do now is turn to page 52 and I wrap up the first step. So when I first got here, and this is for my first 18 months, I thought that the powerlessness had to do with what happened to me after I started using. And I thought the mental obsession was why my life was unmanageable, because I was so obsessed with getting high that I couldn't pay my bills, that I was no good in a relationship, that I couldn't give my employer an honest day's work. All of that, it was the obsession, right? That's why my life was unmanageable. And then I was about between the 16-month mark and 18 months. I didn't have an obsession, but my life was unmanageable. I was spending more money than I had, and I was treating women with disrespect because I was just the activities that I was engaging in were not activities that a spiritually fit person would engage in, the way I was treating people and taking advantage of them. So I found myself uneasy, easily annoyed, and I began to ask myself if this was all there is. So there was a sense of boredom in recovery. And Nari's gone, so I'm going to tell the story now. I was at the Alpharetta group, or the Vaughn House. No, it was Alpharetta Group. And I had about 9 months. And Nari, if you guys know Nari, he burns CDs and he hands them out. So he handed me these two CDs, and I put them in my car door. About 6 or 7 months later, I'm driving home one night from a meeting, and I was at that place, very close to probably drinking and using, but I didn't really know how close I was. And I put in this CD, and it's a man named Mark Houston, and he starts his talk off with, "I love meetings that start with meditation." And it just struck something in me, so I listened to it. And the other CD went in directly after that, and it was our friend Chris R., and he was talking about this spiritual malady, and when he explained it, I knew what I was going through right then and there. And it was a part that I had been missing up to that point. Because the guys that I got clean and sober with, God bless them, they were incredible, and they were exactly what I needed at that point in my recovery. But they were big Joe and Charlie guys, and they were big Step 1 guys and Step 12 guys. And there was very little work done between with those 2 through 11 steps. And as a result of that, I had surrendered to drugs and alcohol, but very little about my character had changed in those first 18 months. I became willing to do whatever I had to do to not smoke crack and drink whiskey. But the surrender to self had not taken place. So I began to reach the bottom with the second half of the first step at 18 months. And it was really important for me because that's what catapulted me into the second surrender to self, which we're going to get to here in a little while. So when I take a guy through the steps and I want to talk about unmanageability, I get it that when we arrive here, unmanageability, DUIs, drug arrests, going to treatment, losing relationships, losing custody, losing money, all of that external unmanageability is closely related to the drugs and alcohol. But the further away you get from your last drink or drug, you're going to see what the true unmanageability is. It's an internal condition. It's not external. Ultimately, if the internal condition festers long enough, it'll manifest itself in the external world, eventually into a drink and a drug, and then you activate the physical craving, and then you burn everything to the ground. But I've watched people burn shit to the ground without any drugs or alcohol in recovery. So, what's unmanageability? We're going to look at this from an internal perspective. I just go through and ask myself these questions. What personal relationships am I having trouble with? And I'm looking at judgment, resistance, separation. What areas of my life am I miserable? What areas of my life cause me to get a little depressed? Where am I full of fear? Where am I unhappy? Where do I find myself not being able to be of real help to other people? Where do I feel useless? That's unmanageability. So I go through and I identify all the different areas of my life. There could be the home group, sponsorship, physical fitness, the family, the child, health, money. These are all different areas, and I'll go through each area and ask myself these questions, and it'll give me a snapshot of my current unmanageability. The mental obsession doesn't just show up one day. There's something that festers. The breeding ground to bring the obsession back is the internal condition, which is unmanageability. It's a three-part problem. Yes, powerlessness is a mental and a physical thing. There are two things that are coupled together, but they're rooted in a spiritual malady, which is a conscious separation from God. And when I'm consciously separated from God, I am self-centered. That means I think about me all the time. I'm wrapped up in the paralysis of analysis. I'm thinking about myself over and over, and it's a consistent, solitary self-appraisal. And that is insufficient. It does not work. So unmanageability has to be addressed on a regular basis because there are areas in my life where there is no God. I completely rely on my logic and my reasoning, and it always gets me in trouble. And that's how we find out what our current unmanageability is. And it's the best barometer, one of the best barometers to see what's really going on. Because if I'm blocked here, I'm ineffective as a sponsor. Because then I don't want my sponsees to see I'm struggling and I begin to live a double life. Men that I sponsor know that I will share this with them any day of the week. I'm not a sponsor that believes I walk in front of the men I sponsor. They walk side by side with me after we've worked the steps. They become my teachers. They all know that. So that's, I think I'm going to wrap up there. That's the three aspects of the first step. Now, look, it took us the better part of a day to get through the first step. The same, I mean, Brandon, I love when he breaks down the amount of material the book devotes to the first step. The doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, three pages in the agnostic chapter devoted to step one. 54 pages, I believe, total. That's a lot. That's the whole foundation here. But the missing piece to all of it is this spiritual malady. Now, these things called the bedevilments are not the spiritual malady. I've heard them referred to as a spiritual malady. They are not. The spiritual malady is conscious separation from God. And when that happens, this is what happens. These bedevilments come to the surface. This is our checklist. Okay? Step one is complete. So now we're going to move into the second step, and Brandon's going to cover that.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brandon. Yeah, it's funny. I was totally going to go into the breakdown of the chapters and point out the fact that here we are in session six, and we're just now wrapping up the first step. So this was confusing to me, because when I went to my first meeting in the first, 90 days, I heard people say things like, well, I showed up here, so I'm done my first step. Then why the hell does the book take so many pages to explain it to me? Because I believe that I'm so delusional that if you just tell me that I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to be like, got it. I believe that the reason why the book has so many pages devoted to the first step is because I need to experience the fact that I am absolutely, positively fucked without God. And here, difficulty arises with those who are atheists or agnostics. Why? Well, because we all think that we know what God means and what God is. So, one of the best readings on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, out of 365 Tao, is called Donkey. Dismount your donkey at the summit. Some places in this world are very hard to climb, and people use animals. Each person can ride only one, and each animal might have a different name. The riders go up the trail in different orders, and they discuss varying opinions about their experiences. They may even have conflicting opinions. One traveler may think the trip thrilling. Another may find it terrifying. And the third may find it banal. At the summit, all the travelers stand at the same place. Each of them has the same chance to view the same vistas. The donkeys are put to rest and graze. They are not needed anymore. We all travel the path to our Creator. The donkeys are the various doctrines that each of us embraces. What does it matter which doctrine we embrace as long as it leads us to the summit? Your donkey might be a Zen donkey. Mine might be a Tao donkey. There are Christian, Islamic, Jewish, and even agnostic donkeys. Big book donkeys, meeting maker make it donkeys. All lead to the same place. Why poke fun at others over the name of their donkey? Aren't you riding one yourself? We should put aside both the donkeys and our interim experiences once we arrive at the summit. Whether we have climbed in suffering or joy is immaterial. We are there. All religions have different names for the way of getting to the holy summit. Once we reach the summit, we no longer need names, and we can experience all things directly. I love when people tell me that they don't believe in God, because through a series of questions, I just tell them, well, you just don't believe in the God that you think you don't believe in. And they kind of look at me like, what? I'm like, yeah, you've just been taught that this is what God is, and you don't believe in that. I don't either. But if I have enough time with you, I'll convince you that there's a God out there that's just not the God that you think there is. And now they're intrigued. How are you going to convince me of that? They don't say, there's no way you're convincing me. They say, how are you going to convince me of that? Oh, opening. We can find a way in now. So, there's a chapter called We Agnostics, chapter 4, which is devoted to, is there a possibility that there's a God out there? The problem is that we all have God based on the country that we live in, the Christian God that we've been given as a country, regardless of whether or not we have other leanings. Our country's a Christian country. It's just how it was founded. Our laws are based on Christian beliefs, all these things. So when we hear the word God, we think, oh, it's that one. It's not that one. That's just the one that you think it is. But it's not that one. So if we really start diving into this, and Tarek touched on it, lack of power. That's my dilemma. Well, I'm not mad. I don't believe in God. Why don't you believe in God? Well, because God took away my mom when I was a kid. Well, how can you be mad at something that doesn't exist? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So it's not just about drinking. It's about solving your problem. And it's a book that will explain to you how to do that. Well, strange. Very strange. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. It means, of course, that we are going to talk about, I'm going to call it the universe because it seems that even within myself have less resistance. Here difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship, but his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he neatly evaded or entirely ignored. So, again and again and again, I will talk to guys where they're just so resistant to it. And once we start getting in and opening up that possibility that we've said the set-aside prayer before we have started several sessions, and it's because my mind continues to take me back to itself. I can't fix my mind with the mind that's in my mind because it's even hard to explain because it's the same thing. So, page 46, the second paragraph. We have agnostic temperament, have had these thoughts and experiences. The resistance, right? Somebody mentions a certain guy that lived about 2016 years ago and in a meeting, and I was talking about it with somebody earlier. His name comes up, and it's like, well, I read it in a text, and I'm okay with it, but if somebody says it out loud in a meeting, I got all sorts of resistance to it. Strange. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we are able to lay aside prejudice, which just means preconceived ideas and opinions, which basically just says that I think I know everything in the world and you guys are all wrong, and express even a willingness, tiny bit, to believe that there's a power greater than myself, we commence to get results, even though we thought it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. It did not rain for 71 days at my house earlier this year. I got stuff dying all over the place. I wanted it to rain. I can't make it rain. Well, at my house. I can make it rain other places. But, so Mother Nature must be greater than me. Well, there's a start. Is that a power greater than you? How about the cops? Do they have any power over you? Power greater than you? Can't make the sun not come up. Sun's got me beat. There's all sorts of powers greater than me. Money, women, these are all powers greater than me. They have control over me. Alcohol absolutely had power over me. Absolutely. See, so I believe in a power greater than myself. I just don't want to believe in the fact that this power greater than me can actually help me with what's going on with me. The good news is we got a whole chapter to pound this into ourselves. So, page 47, first paragraph. Going back, this kind of goes back to Bill's experience with Abby sitting at his kitchen table, where the book says it in a nice way, but this is the way that I visualize it. I visualize it as Abby's coming, he's talking to Bill about God, right? Well, he probably came and talked to him about Jesus. And Bill's like, I ain't believing this. And so he's like, but you got to believe in this thing if you want to get better. And Bill's like, fuck you, Abby. And he's like, no, but Bill, you've got to get well. You got to believe in this God. And Bill's just like, no. And I can just, this, finally, it's like, you know what? Fuck you, Bill. Go choose your own goddamn God. And walks out and slams the door. And then Bill goes, I can pick my own God? Hey, Abby, come back. Because I think that's really how it happened. I don't think that it was just this, he suggested, why don't you create your own conception of God? Oh, okay, great, wonderful. It's not how it went. So when, therefore, we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies, too, to other spiritual expressions, which you will find in this book. Do not let what you think, because you know everything, have prejudice you may have against spiritual terms. Do not let this deter you from honestly asking yourself what it means to you. What would it be like if you actually got to pick what God looked like? So then, on to the next paragraph, which to me, I love this chapter because you can be 30 days sober or 30 years sober. And this paragraph that we're getting ready to read can apply to you. You just need to change it around a little bit. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself that can improve your life beyond where you are right now? Or is this it? Is this it? 30 minutes, 30 days, 30 years sober. Is this the most you can get out of life? And if you say yes, preconceived idea or opinion, you are saying that you know that there is no way life can get better. What if it could? What if life could go beyond where we are right now? What if I could have more money than I ever needed? What if I could have the greatest relationship in the history of the planet? What if I could love everybody that I came in contact with? What if there's a power that could work in my life that would allow that to happen? Would it make sense to do these steps again? Would it make sense to really do these steps? Because that's what this is asking us. Is there more? Is there more? Is there more? I sure hope so, because it would really suck if there wasn't. So, as soon as you could open up to the possibility that you believe or you're willing to believe that God can help you beyond where you are right now, I can sit up here and assure you that you are on your way. It has been repeatedly proven to me that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Just start from that question. If I could just answer that question, wow, I can actually go someplace. Page 50. Fourth paragraph. Summarizes the steps. I think it indicates our roots a little bit too to the Oxford group, because as you recall, when they wrote this book, there were only 100 sober people on the planet, and this paragraph refers to thousands. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. So it must be more than Alcoholics Anonymous. Might be the Oxford group, maybe it's just mankind as a whole. That flatly declare that they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves. And they have taken a certain attitude towards that power. And they have done other simple things, like the rest of the steps. Then there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. So it seems like people pay attention to the story, so I'm going to tell a quick story around this. So, I am 3 and a half years sober. 3 and a half years sober. And I have, I'm working for a friend and I'm doing a job and I've calculated the fact that I think he's paying me $3,800 for the job, and I calculated that my time and effort put into it, if I was just paying myself $10 an hour and materials and everything came up to like $4,800. So I'm losing money on this deal, right? I'm basically, he's paying me what it cost me in materials to do this job, so I'm doing this nice, beautiful addition onto these people's house for free, right? I have, it's either $14 or $17 in my bank account, and I've maxed out my credit card, and I have a total of $40 worth of credit left. So it's either $54 or $57 left. I can't remember which one it is. I'm getting ready to do the one thing that I said I would never do. I am getting ready to not be able to make a child support payment to the mother of my children. I've added up my bills, and I have like $1,600 due right now, and I have a total of $2,700 due in like the next 3 days. And I have, we'll just be generous and say I have $57. I'm getting ready to meet this guy, and he's going to give me a check for $800, and it's not even going to touch it. And I'm sitting in my meditation chair. I've added all this stuff up. I'm looking at a notepad just like this. I'm fucked. I cannot do this. And just then, my lovely, the woman I'm married to, she comes out of the bathroom and she says, "You know, you like to say that you like things to be obvious." She says, "Isn't it obvious that this isn't working and that maybe you got to go get a corporate job again?" And it's like, you know, that's great. That makes sense to me, but that's not helping us right now. How am I going to get through this right now? Yes, it's obvious I need to do something else, but that's not helping us. And so she walks back in the bathroom, and I look at the notepad, and I said, "God, you handle this shit because I can't do it." 7:30 a.m. on a Monday. A couple ideas come into mind over the next couple hours, make some phone calls. By 9:30 on Wednesday, 50 hours later, I've paid all of my bills, and I have $3,600 in my bank account. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. The first of which is surrender, that you can't do it on your own. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, I hope my story shows how the underlying reasons why I was making a heavy going of my financial life, leaving aside the drink question, oh wait, this doesn't even have to do with drinking, I'm sure that in my story I could tell you why living was so unsatisfactory. But when I show how the change came over me, when I can give you hundreds of examples of me and other people, and how I'm able to say that the consciousness, here's that word again, of the presence of God is today the most important fact of my life, I hope I present a powerful reason why one should have faith. The consciousness, not belief in, consciousness. I didn't believe God would help me with my financial situation. But even if I believed that God would help me in my with my financial situation, that's not enough. I had to sit there and pray for the consciousness of making the right decision. Who do I need to call? What should I do? I do these things, money shows up. It's magic. No other way to explain it. Straight magic. Why do I believe in God? Why, when I'm sitting across from another person and they say God does not exist, I sigh and say, I feel sorry for you. Because I have had thousands of experiences like that where there's no doubt that God exists. Why are you questioning it? Come spend some time with me. I'll point it out in your life too. It's all over the place. You just don't see it because you're too absorbed with, oh wait, let's go to page 53. So, in the middle of 53, well, logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance that we are given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, to draw conclusions. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal that does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell you why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it more sane and logical to believe than not believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy, because I would always throw up my hands when I was in doubt and say, I don't know. But when I became an alcoholic, or a person that can't manage his own money, by some sort of becoming crushed by some sort of self-imposed crisis, I could not postpone or evade. I had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What's my choice to be? I don't know. I don't know what my choice is, but if I go to page 54... I can see that if I'm looking at that first full paragraph, that I had been a worshiper. Had I not variously worshiped people, sports teams, females, males, sentiment, things, money, maybe myself. Look at me. Look how good I'm doing. And then with a better motive, had I not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us has not loved something or somebody? How much of these feelings, these loves, these worships have anything to do with pure reason? Little or nothing. How do you prove to somebody you love them? Well, how do you really love me? How can you really show that you love somebody? You can't. It's an experience. Were not these things the tissue out of our lives, that our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of my existence? All these things that I worship, look at that sentence differently. Did not my love of women, of money, of a particular sports franchise or something like that, didn't they determine the course of my existence? Didn't I go places because of these things? So it was impossible for me to say that I had no faith or love or capacity for faith or love or worship. Because if you look at my life, I was always driven by a certain kind of faith and little else. So, what are you worshiping today? What preoccupies most of your time? Like I said earlier, what if our thoughts are really prayers? I said that in a meeting one time, and a guy said, well, those would be some pretty fucked up prayers. Yes, they are. But what happens if maybe I can consciously plug into whatever that thing is, and then I clear away my wrong motives, and I get to tap into this thing, and I get to co-create with whatever this power is, and then crazy good things start happening in my life, and then I get more evidence that this faith thing is pretty cool, and that this consciousness thing is pretty cool. Why wouldn't I want to keep going? Why wouldn't I want to go deeper? Why wouldn't I want more out of this experience?
Thanks, Brandon. In order to work a second step and come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, you have to be insane. So, in the beginning, it's easy to see the insanity around that first drink or drug. And that's what we work with. So let's assume you're sponsoring somebody through the steps and they've already been through the steps. How do you address that? The Big Book's definition of insanity is the best I've ever heard. I absolutely despise. And there's not many things I despise in this world, but I do despise the treatment center definition of insanity. Doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. I like the Big Book's definitions. The lack of proportion and the ability to think straight. So I went through the steps back in March. In about 3 months, I went back through the first 9 steps. I did 5 fifth steps. I prayed to God. He said, you need to do 5 fifth steps. And I said, no, I'm going to ignore that. And I'm going to pray about it a few more days. And the number 5 just kept coming. And then I did 5 fifth steps. It was an incredible experience. I enjoyed it. And but I was...
That's with the same piece of inventory.
Yes, same piece of inventory. Current inventory, too. I inventoried the period of time since the last time I went through the steps. And I found myself lacking proportion and the ability to think straight in a few areas in my life. That's what we're talking about here. If you want to look at this from a current perspective, when you're new, the lack of proportion and the ability to think straight around drugs and alcohol, I get that. But now, I had a lack of proportion and ability to think straight around my new professional endeavor. I had a lack of proportion and ability to think straight around my physical body and the food I was putting in my body. I had a lack of proportion and an ability to think straight with some of the ways I was showing up in my home life with my Marcy, who is my wife, and my daughter Callie. And so I looked at all these areas, and I was limited in those areas. On my own power, I was experiencing unmanageability. On my own power, I cannot remove the bedevilments from my life. I must have a power greater than myself that I can co-create, recreate these areas. And you know, sometimes I struggle, and the struggle goes away, and the struggle comes back. But for me, struggle is, I welcome struggle. I do welcome struggle because it's changing my character. I don't live a life that seeks comfort. I struggle, and that's I'm okay with that. Existence to me is struggle. And so I love the book. I am a student of the Big Book. I'm an applicator of the Big Book. And I love finding, like Brandon does, we find these other books that sort of are talking the same language. And so page 55 for me is one of the coolest pages in the book because it tells you when you're going to find God. It tells you where you're going to find God, and it tells you how you're going to find God. And so I'm going to read through this real quick, and then I want to read this reading. Yet this is page 55. Yet we had been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but we like to tell ourselves it ain't true. Actually, we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every woman, man, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It might be obscured by calamity, bad things that happen to us, pomp, ego, by worship of other things. In some form or other, it is always there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are as facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend or a lover. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. Here's where you find God. We find the great reality deep down within us. When, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It sort of goes in line with that saying that this is the last house on the block, the last place that we ever look. The Hindus have this amazing story of Brahman, which is all of creation, was existing, and it decided to play a game with itself. It was gonna turn itself into an infinite number of pieces, and it was gonna give each piece amnesia, and the game was to see which pieces were gonna claim their inheritance and know where they came from. And so it hid itself inside each piece. It's the last place we ever look for. I grew up in a family where the idea of God is like, we're here, God is here, you have to do a bunch of good things here to get to God there. That's how I grew up. I don't believe that anymore. And this goes in line with what, yes, I don't believe the God that I think is God. I don't have any belief in that. But when somebody presents me with this idea of possibly your ideas don't work, let's work with some new ideas, it changes the game. So here's how you find God. If we can only clear the ground a bit, if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, so in order to do that, we work with a set-aside prayer. God, please set aside all my old ideas so I can have an open mind and a new experience. If it enables you to think honestly, the program later on, it says that this program demands rigorous honesty. Have you ever asked yourself if that's what that really means to you? I think that's what the authors of the book meant.
So wait, to be honest with yourself means to be honest with yourself?
I think so, yeah.
Strange.
And if you search diligently within yourself, not outside of yourself, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness, there's that word again, the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. I want to read something. It's called A Basket of Fresh Bread. I'm a big Rumi fan. This is out of one of Rumi's books. There is a basket of fresh bread on your head, yet you go door to door asking for crusts. Knock on the inner door, no other, sloshing knee deep in clear steam water. You keep wanting a drink from other people's water bags. Water is everywhere around you, but you see only barriers that keep you from water. A horse is moving beneath the rider's thighs, yet the rider still asks, "Where is my horse?" Right there under you. Yes, this is a horse, but where's the horse? Can't you see? Yes, I can see, but whoever saw such a horse? Mad with thirst, he cannot drink from the stream running so close by his face. He's like a pearl on the deep bottom, wandering inside the shell, where is the ocean? His mental questionings form the barrier. His physical eyesight bandages his knowing. Self-consciousness plugs his ears. Stay bewildered in God, and only that. We have a veil that covers our eyes. Literally. I mean, we live in a world where we look at something and we have our past experiences and it is our filter, and we define everything we look at. We fragment it. We dissect it. Then we categorize it and we move on. We lack the capacity to really see things in totality as they are. We're always working off the computer mind. What this process has driven me into this place where I want to seek this experience of totality, of really seeing things as they are, and to depend less and less on my computer mind. The computer mind is all it is a sum of my programming, all of my life experiences. And this is where I've gone with this work, and it's such a simple process that I don't need to look very far to tap that unsuspecting inner resource. It's here, it's with me all the time. But we live in a culture. We are slaves to culture. We're slaves to ideas that were given to us that were not our ideas. And so we have to be deprogrammed. And that's the beauty of the second step, is this idea that I can work with any conception. My conception of God over the last few years has pretty much stayed the same. But in the first 6 years, my conception changed every year. And the best definition of freedom that I've ever run across is the ability to doubt and question everything without having any rigidity in your life. And the way Brandon and I communicate is there isn't much rigidity in our conversations when we compare our notes about God. And sometimes he'll present some stuff to me and I don't really know what to think of it. But I consider it, and vice versa. That's the beautiful part of this process, that with that type of intent, you cannot get bored with this stuff. It will never get stale. But as soon as you say, this is the way it is, the veil goes down. The veil goes down.
You know, this morning we went to breakfast beforehand. And on the way over here, I was sitting here thinking, is any of this real? Like, really, is any of this real? Like, am I the only thing that's really here and you're all here just for my entertainment? And so we get to breakfast and I asked Derek, I was like, are you real? I mean, like, legitimate question. Are you real? And he, like, looks at me and he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, does that, like, when I ask you that question, do you know you're real? And he's like, well, yeah. And I'm like, okay, so it's not just me here. There's somebody else here. But why not ask somebody else that question? Maybe I'm not real. Maybe I'm part just up here giving this example so that you can feel like you're real. How do you prove you're real?
Yeah.
There's no real way. You can touch yourself, you could, but maybe that's part of the game. What if nothing really exists?
I am.
What's that?
I think, therefore, I am.
Descartes thought so, but if you go back to the much older text, I am, therefore, I am. So.
This can be extremely fun. If you're willing to lay aside prejudice, think honestly, and search diligently within yourself, you can join us on the broad highway. The realm of the spirit is room. It's roomy. It's broad. It's inclusive, never forbidding or exclusive. There is
anybody
no,
can come?
Anybody can come.
Really?
Yeah.
So not just certain people are allowed to come into this heaven that we exist in?
No.
Oh. Weird.
Interesting. All right, chapter 5, how it works. I'm going to run us through the third step. And then we're going to have another speaker meeting. We're all familiar with how it works. I want to point out one quick sentence. This manner of living demands rigorous honesty. If you are a sponsor and your sponsees relapse, you must have a conversation with them when they get back, and you must find the dishonesty that they are living under. Every relapse is grounded in dishonesty. I'll say that again. Every relapse is grounded in dishonesty. You cannot be spiritually fit and live a dishonest life. There's going to be things they're not doing, and there are going to be mistakes that were being made. People relapse for one reason, they're not in fit spiritual condition. If you want a greater explanation, come talk to me at the break. All right, so I take someone through the steps. We've done all this work up to this point. I break the third step into four parts. I'm sitting here, I'm talking with a guy, we're reading how it works, we're going through the steps, and we get to the ABCs, and I push my book away from me, and I say, look, buddy, you have to convince me, based on everything we've done in this book, and based on your experience, why A, B, and C are true for you. There is no point in going any further if this is not... The next paragraph starts with being convinced you're now at step three. Why go any further if the person you're taking through the steps is not convinced? And I'll be honest with you, I'm quite fascinated by the amount of people I've taken through this book, and when you get to A, B, and C, they can't describe it to you. They can't tell you why out of their own experience that A, B, C are true for them.
They covered 67 pages of the book, and they still can't answer this question.
And if you can't answer it for yourself, it's highly doubtful that you're not going to be able to take someone through the steps so they can see it about their experience. This is vital and this is crucial. ABCs, you must be convinced. There's no point in moving forward. So you're taking a guy through the steps that's been around for a while. How does step two apply? Can God take you past here? I'm sure you're willing to believe. That's not the question. Can God once again recreate this area in your life?
Will God take you beyond here?
To greater dimensions of love and existence. That's the question that has to be asked. Do you believe? Do you believe? So once we cover step three, section A, we move on to step three, section B, which is the requirement. The requirement is that I have to be convinced that my life run on my ideas and my belief systems, that's what my self-will is, can hardly be a success. You guys ever notice that when you're about to pass away, they encourage you to write a last will and testament? What are you doing when you write your last will? Aren't you judging everybody in your life for the very last time? I always have found it interesting that you're making a decision to turn your life and your will, and so much of that is our judgment. My judgment keeps me separated from other people. Once I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. And so a lot of my current work with step three involves the ideas that I have about the world and the people in it. Because it's based out of judgment, based out of my limited experience. And so I go, these pages were completely missed by me the first time I went through the steps. There was no surrender to the stuff they're talking about on these pages. I was still a producer of confusion rather than harmony. I still lived by self-propulsion. I was in constant collision with people and situations. I was trying to violently twist or pull away from life satisfaction if I only managed well. I was egocentric. I was concerned about my self-pity, my resentments, and my way of doing things. That's what this book lays out, this idea of being a director and a producer and an actor and the light guy and the sound guy all at the same time. Every year when I go through the steps, I can identify areas of my life where this is happening. Yesterday morning at work, completely driven by self-propulsion, where I lashed out at the guys that worked with me, trying to run the whole show. I set the lights in the ballet up this way, and the sound system is set like this, and I'll be damned, but you're going to fit this mold that I've set up. Right? And so what happened? I wrote a piece of inventory and I fist-stepped it with Brandon. I didn't write the inventory to change how I feel. I didn't write the inventory to try to manage my life. I wrote the inventory because I'm completely blocked. I'm completely blocked and I'm not able to see God in these situations. I'm completely driven by my egoic mind and my programming. Because I am a perfectionist, right? So I demand that everyone around me seeks perfection. It's fucking ludicrous. This is what the piece of inventory has shown me thus far. That's how I can make this a current piece of work. Just a current snapshot of what I'm up against. And that brings these pages to life for me over and over. This was less than 36 hours ago. This was me. So, step three, section B. It requires that I see how my life run on those ideas and those beliefs about work can hardly be a success. I have to seek to have some harmony there. And that involves me not imposing my value system on other people. Because when I impose my value system on other people, all I'm really trying to do is run the show. I'm trying to be the producer, the actor, the director all at the same time. So then we get the C. Okay, so I go through these pages. And granted, on page 62, I always have a discussion on these two paragraphs. Probably the authors of the big book were visionaries. What if you opened page one and said, hey, Tarek, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of your troubles. You guys think I would have gone past page one? No, we had to spend a lot of time talking about drugs and alcohol first. But now on page 62, they tell you what the real problem is, and it's not drugs and alcohol. It's selfishness and self-centeredness, and driven by 100 forms of fear. And here I'm here to report that the big book believes in karmic retribution. It says, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably always find that at some time in the past we made a decision based on self, which now in the future has placed us in a position to be hurt. That's karmic retribution, any way you cut it. So Tarek receives the greatest news he's ever received in his entire life, the greatest statement of hope in our big book. Tarek, your troubles are basically of your own making, and they arise out of yourself. And Tarek is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, Tarek must be rid of this selfishness. He must, or it's going to kill him. God makes that possible, not Tarek. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. So they tell me selfishness is going to kill me, and I can't get rid of it. I must have God's help. Tarek's had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but he can't live up to them, even though he really wants to. I can't even reduce my self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on my own power. I have to have God's help. So they just told me that selfishness is going to kill me, and I can't do shit about it. All I can do is seek to deepen my experience with a God of my understanding. And for whatever reason, that reduces the selfishness and self-centeredness that I have in my life. So, this is the how and the why of it. They asked this question the page before. Just what do we do about it, and what do we mean? Well, we quit playing God. Why? Because it doesn't work. Not for us. Next, we decided. So, the decision in the third step is step 3, section C. So, step 3, section A is the ABCs. You have to be convinced. Step 3, section B is that you have to be convinced that your life run on your self-will does not work. Step 3, section C is a decision. It's a contract you're entering into with this power. The contract is you're going to decide hereafter in this drama of life that God's going to be the director. He is the principal. You're his agent. He is the father, and you are his child. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we pass to freedom. They've built a wonderful structure in this book. It's amazing. It's on page 13, Bill talks about the foundation of complete willingness that we get out of our first step. Knowledge out of our experience, not knowledge out of knowledge. Out of our experience, it abundantly confirms to us that we are without power, choice, and control. That solidifies our foundation with the first step. Then on page 17, we pour cement into the foundation. What is the cement? It's a magical combination of problem and solution. You can't have an all-solution meeting. You can't have an all-problem meeting. It has to be a magical combination. The problem is the first layer of healing that happens when you walk into a meeting. Think about it. Think back to when you were new. The first time I really healed was not when I heard the solution. It's when somebody told my story. I heard something that made me feel like I wasn't alone anymore. That was the first aspect of the healing. That by itself, that common peril, cannot hold us together. There has to be more. There has to be the solution aspect, right? So I went to the gates of insanity and almost death. And God brought me back to share my experience. So not only does the common problem play into that, there has to be a solution. And that's a magical combination. And that's the cement and the foundation. In the second step, we become willing to believe that God can restore us to sanity. That's a keystone, or that's the cornerstone. And if you've been around for a while, can God take you past where you are? Or is this all there is? That's how you make the second step apply. And now the keystone is the decision. God, you're going to do these things, and these things are going to be my responsibility. My life's no longer my business. What I want doesn't matter. I no longer get a vote. I'm here to testify. The third step is about testimony. We are compelled to bear witness. So when I define these roles, director, actor, principal, agent, father, child, employer, employee, that's the contract. I write out a third step decision prayer. And then the affirmation, which is step 3, section D, that is the prayer in the third step. So in the first step, self-examination. In the second step, I go to God. I start thinking about my conceptions of God. The third step for me is about testimony. I am compelled to bear witness as God removes my difficulties. That's what it's about. So it's focusing on others. As we go through the steps the rest of this weekend, you're going to see this over and over. Self-examination, go to God, go to others. Self-examination, go to God, go to others. That's what we do here. That's the third step. So the affirmation is this prayer, and it's an amazing prayer. And so what I would like to wrap this session up with is a moment of silence, and let's all read the third step prayer together. Prayer. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them will bear witness to those that I will help with Thy power, Thy way of life, and Thy love. May I do Thy will. Come back in 15 minutes.